will do anything you ever need done. It comes with a disc that has to be broken down. It is so large and so heavy that it has to be cut into thirds to be able to bring it home. But it goes with it. It's a little sad that the plows went away, but by spring, the world should look a little different for you ones. A lot different for a lot of ones, but not necessarily negative for here. And we are grateful. And I would hope that they could take a drive out, or somebody would bring a picture or do something, because you have a new baby. And we're grateful. And we thank you. In the process of house cleaning, if you will, a lot now of communication is available to EJ and Charles with ones back east who grow spelt, have spelt, handle it. So they are learning a lot about both the product, and EJ was able to get another semi load at less than half price of spelt. So we're in pretty good shape if the world ended today. Well, I mean, if it got kind of survival time today. Is there anything else we could, before break, cover here?
I could briefly mention the status of the earth.
What do you mean? Where were you when we needed you?
Well, Ed, if you're going to talk about the earthquake, why don't you come and get the machinery?
I'm more interested in hearing what Soltec says about Japan. I don't believe you were here, Ed, when I was talking about the nuclear testing, and Japan follows on with an earthquake within a week every time.
Well, there's not an official.
I probably should note that you better, when you get home, Claudia and John, you better take a good, close inspection around your property. That was a pretty good-sized jolt, and it's out in the Wind Park area. About it will have hit Cameron Canyon a little bit harder than here.
Oh, that's exactly right. We got some maps out here while you were talking before, Commander, and accurate maps, and it does take you where Cameron Road hits Highway 58. They're just a little bit south of that, just about Claudia's backyard.
Doesn't that make you feel good?
That's exactly where the epicenter is.
If it had been a rolling or a continuous motion thing, we would have acted quickly. But the kind that you had is quite shallow and quite abrupt, and it didn't last long enough to do much damage. So,
but it was clearly on the Garlock Fault.
Yes.
No doubt about that. Right there. In fact, it might even have been, as you go along Highway 58 towards Mojave, on the right-hand side, you know the big dirt pile there that's sliding down on towards the railroad tracks? It ought to be right about there.
So right where you come under the shield.
Yes, right where you come under the shield, exactly.
Right.
That's right. You can feel it. Some, I don't know, I'll mention that briefly, but it is possible as you reach that point where there's a sign saying Tehachapi ahead, and you can see the cement plant on the right. There's a spot there, if you're sensitive and you're driving along, where you can actually feel as you come under the umbrella of the shielding. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed it for several years, but I don't say anything about it, because why talk about it for people who don't pick it up? As long as it's there, who cares whether you feel it or not? Now, what I do want to talk about, Commander mentioned in a writing earlier this week about about the underground nuclear blast, the underwater nuclear blast, and Tonios did talk about that once a while ago. He has not directly given me any new information, either directly or through other sources, but he wanted to emphasize the fact that we must continue to watch Japan very closely, and not just Japan, but then down south of us in Mexico, the continuing quakes that are coming up that way. The important, alarming information I have here in front of me that is most telltale of what is just around the corner, and why Commander probably wrote on it for this week's paper. The first map I have here is the Southern California map, and I'll turn it around in a second. But a long time ago, I gave you indications of two lines, two big triangles, one from Santa Barbara up to Lake Isabella. I need a... one's from Santa Barbara up to Lake Isabella, and then down through this side of Palm Springs down to the Salton Sea. That was one triangle, and then the other one was a very distinct triangle around Palm Springs, just a smaller triangle connected to the larger one. Now, what's happened in the last week, though? This is this week's December 21 to 27 report from Caltech. What's happened here is that instead of there being clear definition of earthquake slippage along specific faults, there is now splattering of quake activity all over this area around Palm Springs. In other words, it looks like you just took some ink spots or a pen and splattered quake activity around here. In other words, it's no longer well defined. That means that the stresses are built up to such a level that breakage is occurring along pieces that weren't even parts of faults before. So this whole area here around Palm Springs is now turning into mush. Now that's in the Southern California area. That's alarming enough. Now over here is Northridge. This thing you can see over here, this blob of things, the cluster of activity is getting wider and wider around Northridge too, meaning that the breakup of underneath the ground in that San Fernando Valley area is becoming more and more pronounced. So those are two indications of what's going on in Southern California, but that's not the scariest one. The scariest one, here's a map from a publication called SeismoWatch, and this is Northern California. And here's the San Andreas Fault right here, and these two over here, just you can hardly see on the difference on here, but where they all come together, this is the Hayward and Calaveras faults, the East Bay faults, and they all come down in the Silicon Valley into this area here, and that's where they merge together. And I always call this the triple junction point here, because any activity down along here, down as far as Parkfield, that where they have all the instruments, is significant, because as the motion goes up, it'll split and go through the East Bay, through Oakland, and up there that direction, or out to San Andreas. Well, normally there might be a few quakes in this triple junction area, but I don't know how well you can see from here, but the amount of activity in this last week between the 7th and the 13th, well, this is data for the 7th to the 13th of December, and the amount of activity here, this big fat cluster of activity, would normally be what you might see in 3 to 4 months of activity, and this was all within 1 week. Now, what this means in terms of slippage along this fault line now means that all of this has moved. So the pressure has now moved up along the San Andreas, up along the Calaveras, and the Hayward Fault. So the amount of added pressure on those faults is now probably, I could only guess at a factor of 100 to 500 times what it was just the week before the slippage occurred. So if you talk about two setups ready to go, one around Palm Springs and one here at the triple junction point just south of Silicon Valley, here in San Jose, a little south of San Jose. This is a beautiful area down through here where a lot of artichokes and garlic and things are grown. But it's going to be moving pretty soon. So those are the main things I wanted to note, because it's not to be an alarm for those of us who are ready and have followed Tonios's instructions. When I ask him, is there anything new? He says, I've said everything I need to say. You go back and read my writings and get ready. But the stresses have built up tremendously, and the nuclear testing in the South Pacific is only aggravating that, as Commander said in the writing earlier this week, because it is causing further slippage of the plates at a point where they are slightly hung up. So it's very clever that they picked that spot out in the Pacific to detonate these nuclear blasts.
Well, they're using them as much as you would a jet engine.
Yes.
To thrust. And once you have broken through the inertia, you'll have major slippage. So it's intentional. They know what they're doing.
The other point that is having a lot of activity right now is up in Alaska. It's not new, but it is getting worse. If you think of where Alaska is, there, well, I can show you. Here. I need you. There's a here's Alaska, Canada, and Alaska. There, this is Mount McKinley, right in this area here in Fairbanks, up here at the top. There's a line along here about two fingers wide here going down where there's tremendous splitting going on of Alaska. This is the Pacific Plate boundary down here, and it's trying to push this way. So what it's doing is cracking this side of Alaska off from the other side. And it's actually pushing this out, so you're getting quake slippage all through this middle area here. Almost think of a big evergreen tree sitting right about here, and that's why this big splattering of quakes. Now, this is relatively light on this week's map. The last two or three months of maps have been so heavy you can't even read the print of the cities underneath. So these are indicative between Southern California, Northern California, and Alaska, and the thousands of quakes that are occurring in Japan that are never reported in our media. If you just think of those several points, you can just picture the Pacific Plate trying to move. And they help it along, as Commander said, with a little jet engine burst to try to get it freed up at that one spot. So to say that we're on the verge of some very big, big movement as soon as that moves a little bit is from the data I have here, quite an understatement.
Let this one just now be a warning to you. That is a pre-shock. Now, remember from the time we first started visiting, we said we believe that we can keep this area into and under a 3.7. Well, you're talking about the edge of the shield, and that's going to register, well, as Ed says, on the Kmart scale, maybe it's a 4. That was a little stronger. But because of its location and its shallowness and some other things, you can consider it a pre-shock because you haven't had any major Garlock shocks in a long time. You will note that all these others have been on little side faults. So this is to get your attention. You who treasure your porcelain, put your rubber bands back on. And the worst that they'll have is to deteriorate. Just go with it. Things are going to start happening. There's no way to avoid it.
Commander, we have a little update on the Kmart scale for this today's. Has been downgraded now to a 3.3.
Already?
Depth and location are the same.
Well, considering the news media now considers a 7 magnitude quake a moderate quake.
Wait a minute, that wasn't a downgrade, that was a second quake.
Oh. Haven't you been sitting here? I really want to call a break because she's going to get seasick sitting here. The earth is swaying. Yes.
Let's sing happy birthday to Marilyn. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Marilyn. Happy birthday to you.
Thank you. Cake.
It is an undisputed fact of history that during World War II, the Germans ran a network of prison and labor camps both in Germany and in the territories they controlled. Into these camps were sent Jews, prisoners of war, resistance fighters, gypsies, and other people considered enemies of the Third Reich. The largest of these camps was the one called Auschwitz, located in Poland. Those interned at Auschwitz came from all over Europe and consisted of men, women, and children. Those able to work were used as labor for the German war effort. Auschwitz was liberated by the Soviet Army in January of 1945. But that is where the consensus ends. Since the end of World War II, we have been told repeatedly that many of these camps served a darker purpose. The genocide of 6 million Jews and the execution of 5 million non-Jews through the use of homicidal gas chambers in what is now commonly known as the Holocaust. The largest number of people are said to have been murdered at Auschwitz. But there are some people who maintain that these claims of mass murder have never been proven. These people point to the lack of documentation other than the highly questionable and already partially discredited evidence supplied by the Soviet Union at the Nuremberg trial and the unreliable nature of the eyewitness testimonies, many of which have also been discredited. For example, many former camp inmates, as well as American soldiers, still speak of gassings at the Dachau camp in Germany, even though it is no longer held that any gas chamber was ever in use at that camp. Still, the Holocaust is an event that has seemingly grown in importance since the end of the war, taught as fact, usually accepted without question. But how do we know if it really happened? What proofs are offered for those not willing to take history on faith alone? This video deals with, among other things, one of those proofs. One piece in a very large puzzle, the supposed gas chamber at the Auschwitz main camp. This tape is the first in a series of tapes covering my September 1992 trip to Europe to investigate firsthand the sites of the alleged final solution. It is by no means intended to be the last word on the Holocaust controversy, but just the opposite. I hope this tape can begin an open debate that's long overdue. What is fact, and what is simple wartime propaganda regarding the event we have come to know as the Holocaust? This is the Auschwitz main camp, or Stammlager. There are three parts to what is known as Auschwitz. There is Auschwitz I, the main camp, a well-built compound which existed before World War II as a military barracks and was slightly modified by the Germans when they took it over. Then there's Auschwitz II, also known as Auschwitz-Birkenau, which was constructed during the war as an expansion of the main camp. And there's Auschwitz III, or Auschwitz-Monowitz, a large industrial area where many inmates were forced to work. It is Auschwitz I, the main camp, which is the center of Auschwitz tourism. It is here that tours are conducted hourly in English, Polish, German, and French. By their own figures, over 500,000 people visit here every year, and the place has become a curious shrine, a mix of crass commercialism and religious reverence, with a hotel, restaurant, gift shop, and booths selling all manner of video equipment, like batteries and videotapes in all formats, so that no one need worry about missing a shot of the final solution. This is a shrine which combines Catholic expressions of identity and mourning with Jewish ones, and this has traditionally caused some tension. Jewish groups have charged that the Poles downplay the role of Jewish suffering, and while few would openly suggest it, it could be said that, in the West, Jews have attempted to monopolize Auschwitz as a uniquely Jewish experience. Already we reach an important point in our examination of the Holocaust. It is an event interpreted differently in various corners of the world. The Soviets have always stressed the suffering of Russians, Poles, Ukrainians, and others. Post-World War II Soviet propaganda films often made little mention of Jews. To the Polish locals, Auschwitz is given a Catholic face, with all the usual fetishes. The suffering of Polish priests and other martyrs is stressed, and the attempted extermination of the Polish people is the preferred theme. But in the Western world, we get a single-mindedly Jewish interpretation, with the non-Jewish deaths being used mainly to keep non-Jewish interest in the Holocaust alive by giving non-Jews some involvement in it. But we are told that even though non-Jews suffered as well, it is the Jews and the Jews only who were marked for extermination. This schism has often resulted in well-publicized disputes. such as the convent of Carmelite nuns who took up residence here at Auschwitz, against the wishes of many Jewish groups, and the time a touring Polish Auschwitz exhibit was protested for not being Jewish enough. However, at the camp itself, there's more than enough victimization to go around. The layout of the Auschwitz main camp is fairly simple. A square of barbed wire fence surrounds rows and rows of inmates' barracks, a large mess hall, and a few surprises, which we will get to later. Outside the fenced-in area are the SS headquarters, these two buildings, and the SS hospital and restaurant. Across from that is the building known as Crematorium 1, the infamous gas chamber and crematorium. Most of the inmates' barracks have been converted into museums, which make up the bulk of the guided tour. The rest of the barracks are used as either archives or offices for museum staff. One barrack, Block 11, has been kept in its original state. It was the camp prison, and it is now referred to, naturally, as the Block of Death. Which brings up another interesting point: what is shown on the tour and what is not. During the tour, you are shown the Block of Death, the so-called Wall of Death, naturally right next door to the Block of Death, and exhibit after exhibit specifically designed to affirm atrocity stories and portray Auschwitz as a death machine, a place where internment meant extermination. But what don't they show you? To start with, a building which could conceivably be called the Block of Life, a massive disinfestation complex where Zyklon B gas was used daily to combat lice and the disease they carried. These were the real gas chambers, except their victims were clothing and mattresses, and their purpose was to preserve the health of the inmates. Holocaust experts don't deny the purpose of this building. They just don't like mentioning it. After all, why complicate things? Also forgotten is the Auschwitz Camp Theater, the current home of the aforementioned convent of nuns. The last pictures taken inside this building showed pianos and costumes and a stage where the inmates used to put on productions. These days, however, the nuns don't allow pictures to be taken inside. And finally, we have the Auschwitz swimming pool. Yes, that's right, swimming pool. Situated inside the prison compound, right alongside the inmates' barracks. A beautiful pool with a diving board and starters blocks for races. To their credit, the Auschwitz camp officials have not tried to remove this distraction, but if you want to see the pool, you need to know already that it exists, because you won't find it on the tour. So basically, what we have is a tour that consists mainly of tourists who already believe in the Holocaust story, and are perhaps emotionally connected to it in some way, being given a selectively edited tour filled with horror story after horror story, and ending up at the final stop, the gas chamber. At that point, the tour group is emotionally primed to believe anything, and the gas chamber is like the featured performer after a two-hour warm-up act to get the crowd in the mood. Literally, the gas chamber is the objective proof that everything they've heard on the tour is true, objective proof of the Holocaust. But is it? We'll see in a minute. I went to Auschwitz in September of 1992 to see for myself this place that I have studied for so long. I paid extra for a personal English language tour guide, a young lady named Alicia who gives tours in Polish, German, and English. And I wore my yarmulke, just so nobody missed the point that I'm Jewish. I figured that way I could ask my questions in a manner that would not make me look like a revisionist. You see, in the past, revisionists haven't had much success in getting answers from the Auschwitz officials. But I would come off as a righteous Jew, wanting to know the real facts, and answer those who say the Holocaust never happened. For the sake of clarity, not only am I a revisionist, I am also quite proudly an atheist. But my parents are both Jewish, so if you're a Jew by birth, you're a Jew by birth. It's not anything I'd be ashamed of. Alicia, like the other tour guides, had to take a class and memorize a spiel to become one. This is an important point because I'm hoping to show that the people who run Auschwitz, like Dr. Franciszek Pieper and the tour guide supervisor you'll meet shortly, teach their tour guides to say things they know aren't true. But this shouldn't reflect badly on Alicia. She only repeats what she's been told, and I'm sure she never had to put up with a tourist like me before. I have over 4 hours of footage of me taking the tour, asking one obnoxious question after another. This footage will be re-edited into a separate tape. This time, we're just going to concern ourselves with the gas chamber and my interview with Dr. Franciszek Pieper, senior curator and head of archives at the Auschwitz State Museum. I came to Auschwitz as a confirmed skeptic about the gas chamber story. I know to some people, critically examining the Holocaust is the ultimate sacrilege. But you'll have to realize that I have no sacred cows, and understanding what really happened is important to me, and I'd ask that you respect that. I know from years of my own research, and the research of others, that proofs of the Holocaust are few. Literally, all there is are the eyewitness testimonies and post-war confessions. There is no picture, plan, or wartime document dealing with homicidal gas chambers or a plan to exterminate the Jews. And we can't use the excuse that the Nazis destroyed all the evidence, because after we had broken the German code, we were able to intercept their secret transmissions, including those that came from Auschwitz. The key to understanding the Holocaust story is understanding the true nature of the things passed off as proofs. Everything that is used as evidence of the Holocaust also can be said to have a perfectly normal explanation. For example, these exhibits are said to be the material proofs of exterminations. There's the piles of human hair. But what does that prove? It's acknowledged that each inmate had his or her head shaved because of the lice problem. That's not denied. So why wouldn't there be piles of human hair? What about the piles of shoes and clothing? Is that a proof? It's a fact that the prisoners were issued a uniform upon arrival, including shoes. So why wouldn't there be piles of inmates' shoes and clothing? It doesn't prove anybody was killed. And that's giving the Soviets and Poles the benefit of the doubt that the clothes and hair are genuinely from the camp during its operation. What about the canisters of gas? No one denies that Zyklon B was used to disinfect clothes and also buildings. Zyklon B was one of the premier pest control agents in Europe at that time. It was present in most of the concentration camps, including those that are not said to have had homicidal gas chambers in them. The typhus epidemic that spread throughout Europe during the war and also spread through the camps called for stringent lice control procedures. In his book, Auschwitz Technique and Operation of the Gas Chambers, published by the Klarsfeld Foundation and meant to refute revisionists, Jean-Claude Prissac admits that over 95% of the Zyklon B used by the Germans was used to disinfect. He assigns only 5% to homicidal purposes, and this from a Holocaust supporter. So what other proofs are offered? Well, there's the usual pictures of sick inmates, which proves the groundbreaking thesis that people got sick in the camp. Once again, I'll add that nobody denies the typhus epidemic, which resulted in many deaths. Then there's the artwork, and the pictures of children. But at this point, it's looking pretty bad for somebody looking for objective proofs of the gas chamber. And some of the proofs they present actually work against the concept. For example, they have one of several aerial photographs taken of Auschwitz by the Allies during the war. They don't mention, however, that when blown up, these photos don't show people being gassed or bodies being burned, even though they were taken during the time killings were said to be going on almost non-stop. I won't even go into the special money the Germans printed for Auschwitz inmates, or the fact that even though it is said that Jewish children were killed immediately, both Anne Frank and her sister were sent to Auschwitz and survived, later being transferred to the Bergen-Belsen camp, where they are said to have died from typhus. But all this bickering would be pointless if we could see a genuine gas chamber for ourselves. That, of course, would most effectively end the argument. Which brings us to the building I'm standing in front of, the gas chamber and crematorium. Pictures of this building have been featured in book after book on the Holocaust. After all, what better proof it all happened? Revisionists don't dispute that this is a real building from during the war. We say that it was indeed a crematorium and a mortuary, which also was used as an air raid shelter for the SS men in the hospital and restaurant right across the street from it. The Auschwitz people say it was indeed a mortuary and a crematorium, with the mortuary part, which you're looking at right there, later being used as the gas chamber. They also say that it was used as an air raid shelter. And they have, in the past, admitted that the large brick chimney at the side of the building is a reconstruction, which is no big shock to anybody because it clearly isn't connected to the building in any way. Now let's go inside. Once inside, we can see why revisionists have had such a field day with this building. Obvious marks on the walls and floors, where apparently walls had been knocked down. Equally obvious holes in the floor where bathroom facilities had been. We maintain that, unlike the large hollow chamber we now see, this room had once been 5 rooms, including a bathroom. I should add that there is no Zyklon B blue staining in the walls, as there would have been with repeated Zyklon B use, and as there were and still are in the disinfestation chambers. A flimsy wooden door with a big glass pane in it, and a doorway with no door, and no fittings for a door, leading to the crematorium ovens. And I should also mention the big manhole, right in the middle of the gas chamber. Yet the building does have what appears to be evidence of criminal usage. 4 holes in the ceiling, which lead to the roof, where 4 little chimneys stand. It is said that through these 4 holes, Zyklon B crystals were dropped. And indeed, there seems to be no other explanation for them. Do these holes prove homicidal gassings? Revisionists have claimed in the past that these holes were added after the camp's liberation, and that the inside walls were knocked down and the bathroom facilities removed to make the room look like a big gas chamber. As Alicia and I approach the building, we pass the gallows where the commandant of Auschwitz, Rudolf Höss, was hanged by the Soviets in 1947, executed directly in front of the evidence of his crime. Here, in front of the gas chamber, I ask Alicia about the authenticity of that building. Now let's start again talking about this building here. This
crematorium gas chamber.
But this is a reconstruction.
It is in original state.
Original
state.
Now there, Alicia has very clearly represented the gas chamber as being in its original state. Once inside, I asked her specifically about the 4 holes in the ceiling.
Are those the original holes in the ceiling?
It is in original part, original.
It is original.
Original in through this chimney was from Cyclone B.
I then asked Alicia if any walls had ever been knocked down in the room exhibited as the gas chamber.
So, mm-hmm. Were there walls here at one time?
But here, it was only one room. Only one room. That here I know here, when here I show picture of gas chamber, it was only one room here.
So were there windows there ever were walls here?
No.
Let's pause here to recap the gas chamber according to our tour guide. She states that the room is in its original state, that the ceiling holes are original, and that no walls were knocked down. Unsatisfied with her answers, I continued to badger poor Alicia about the real history of this room, feeling somewhat exasperated at the fact that nothing she could say would shut me up. Alicia went to get a woman who was introduced to me as the supervisor of tour guides for the Auschwitz State Museum. When I saw this woman approach, I figured I was either going to get a straight answer or kicked out of the camp.
This is what I can suggest. It will be much better to go to our scientists in the State Museum and to talk with them. They show you a lot of plans which we still have in the archives.
Where would that be?
I don't think that it's open today, but probably in Monday it will be possible.
That's the Auschwitz State Museum?
Yes.
Is that in Oswiecim?
Here, in block number 24 and 23, I'm not sure about
it. Would it be possible for me to make an appointment to see him on Monday, perhaps?
That's true.
So, it was here that it was first suggested I meet with the head of archives and senior curator, Dr. Franciszek Pieper. Still, fearing that such a meeting might not come about, and assuming that the supervisor was probably in the loop regarding any reconstructions, I decided to get her input regarding the supposedly original holes in the ceiling.
Are those the original holes in the ceiling?
No.
They've been rebuilt?
Yes.
Okay. After the war?
After the war.
So, if you're keeping score, that makes it one vote for original, one vote for not original. I guess that would make Dr. Pieper the tiebreaker. Now, before we proceed any further, a little digression is needed about some genuine Holocaust revisionism. Dr. Franciszek Pieper is one of the Holocaust experts most directly responsible for the lowering of the Auschwitz death count. Along with other scholars like Israeli Holocaust expert Dr. Yehuda Bauer, it was decided around 1989 to admit publicly that fewer people died at Auschwitz than had previously been reported. In his book, Auschwitz, How Many Perished, Dr. Pieper concludes that the old Soviet-provided figure of 4 million is wrong, and that the real figure is closer to 1.1 million. Now, that's no small revision, an admission that the Soviets exaggerated the figure by almost four times. We can also see how the fraudulent figure has been an ingrained part of supposedly factual Holocaust history for almost 50 years. As late as 1988, in the official Auschwitz State Museum guidebook, you'll find on page 19 an official affirmation of the 4 million figure. The Soviet State Extraordinary Commission for the Investigation of Nazi Crimes stated that no less than 4 million people perished in Auschwitz. The Supreme National Tribunal in Poland stated that about 4 million persons perished in Auschwitz. According to the International Military Tribunal in Nuremberg, more than 4 million persons perished in Auschwitz. And these figures are based upon the evidence of hundreds of surviving prisoners and upon the opinion of experts. Well, this shows that not only was fraudulent Soviet evidence admitted as fact at Nuremberg, but also that survivors and experts can be wrong. And, if it matters, many Holocaust revisionists believe that the actual total of dead at Auschwitz is even less than 1.1 million. But still, there's no possibility that even the most extreme Holocaust revisionist in the world could possibly revise the figure any more than the Holocaust experts already have. Which rather neatly brings us to this man, Dr. Franciszek Pieper. I interviewed him in his office at the Auschwitz State Museum. At first, he was a little apprehensive about being videotaped. But I explained to him that since I already had the tour guide on tape, giving out what I had now come to believe was incorrect information, I should have a videotape which could set the record straight. Once he consented, I immediately asked him about changes made in the gas chamber.
So first, since all of this gas chamber, which existed in Auschwitz I, this camp we are now here, operated from autumn 1941 to December 1942, approximately 1 year. Crematorium nearby this gas chamber were longer to the middle of 1943. In July 1943, the crematorium was stopped and the bodies of the prisoners died in Auschwitz I were from the time transferred to Birkenau. In 1944, in connection with the bombardment of Auschwitz by Allied air forces, empty crematorium number one and gas chamber in Auschwitz one were adopted as air shelter. At the time, the additional walls were built inside the former gas chamber. The additional entrance was made from the east side of the gas chamber, and the openings in the ceiling, the gas siphon B was discharged inside, were at the time liquidated. So after the liberation of the camp, the former gas chamber presented the view of a shelter. In order to gain the earlier view, earlier sight of this object, inside walls built in 1944 were removed, and the opening and the ceiling were made annual. So now this gas chamber is very similar to this one which existed in 1941-1942. But not all details were made there, so there is no gas-tight doors, for instance, additional entrance from the east side, rested as it was made in 1944. Such changes were made here after the war in order to gain the rear view of this object.
Were the holes in the ceiling put in the same way that they were?
Yes, in the same in the same place, because the traces were visible on the ceiling.
Here, I think we should recap what Dr. Pieper has told us. According to him, the room was a gas chamber, but was later turned into an air raid shelter. At which time dividing walls were built, the holes in the ceiling were removed, and a new door was added on one side of the gas chamber. However, after the camp's liberation, the dividing walls were knocked down, the holes were put in the ceiling, however, the new door was not removed. I think here there are three main points that have to be made. The first of these is that we are looking at a clear deception. As I have shown, the gas chamber is shown off to tourists as being in its original state, even though the museum officials know better. Dr. Pieper appears to be very nonchalant about the fact that changes were made after the war, but if it isn't such a big deal, then why hide it from the tourists? And that's not all. In May of 1992, British historian David Irving was fined by a German court for telling a meeting in Munich exactly what you've just heard Dr. Pieper tell you. In fact, Pieper was even called as a defense witness, but the judge wouldn't allow him to testify, even though it might have cleared Irving. Once again, I'll say, if this is not such a big deal, why fine somebody for saying it? Our next point is, the gas chamber is no longer valid as proof in its present state. It is not a proof of homicidal gassings unless it can be shown that, at some time during the war, this building had four holes in the ceiling and no dividing walls during the time the Germans were operating the camp, which brings us to our final point. The reconstruction itself. With the information we now have, we can say that there are two different views of the gas chamber reconstruction. The first one, the official view, holds that the Soviets and Poles created a gas chamber in an air raid shelter that had been a gas chamber. The revisionist view holds that the Soviets and Poles created a gas chamber in an air raid shelter that had been an air raid shelter. So, how do we know which one is correct?